today I want to talk about a fast Kobai Dogen in the Shobogenzo, the Tridharma Eye, called Dai Go or Great Enlightenment. Dai means great and Go means enlightenment. So here's the story. The story originally comes from a Chinese text called the Cheng Te Chung Tang Lu, which means transmission of the lamp records. It has 30 books to it. They're not books the way we would think of them. Probably each book would be pretty small. But it's being translated into English right now by a man named Whitfield. And so far he's up to 4 volumes, which I think is maybe book 18. So anyway, here's the story. The story is, a monk once asked the great master about Qi, what happens when a person of great enlightenment still suffers from delusion? What happens when a person of great enlightenment still suffers from delusion? The master says, so here's his response, a broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen blossoms cannot climb back onto the trees. A broken mirror never reflects again. Fallen blossoms cannot climb back onto the trees. So that's the story. That's the teaching story, koan. So what in the world does this mean? So our founder of Soto Zen in Japan, Dogen Zenji, has an answer to this question, which is in his fascicle called Daigo, Great Enlightenment. So first of all, Dogen asks us, make some comments about what it means to be enlightened. So this is something we should think about. He asked, and he says, realization is not inborn, nor is it outside the self. So realization is not inborn, nor is it outside the self. So we say, Buddha nature, all things are Buddha nature. So rather famous quote from Dogen, because in another fascicle called Busho, he takes the Chinese, which can be read as all things are Buddha nature, or all things have Buddha nature, and changes it to all things are Buddha nature. So there's a lot different kind of connotation to having something and being something. Having something, you know, is this idea that it's outside yourself. It's something that you can get, something that you didn't come with. And then are, being something, is that this is your essential nature. So the essential nature of everything, according to Dogen, is the essential nature of Buddha. This interconnected, interpenetrating, no inherently existing state. To realize that, to embody that, is Buddha nature. That is the nature of a Buddha. So that is our essential nature. Realizing it, we already embody it. Okay, so realizing it, Dogen characterizes as Buddhahood. All right? It's very difficult to talk about this using language because language is sequential. So it's really hard to say it in a pithy way. So usually we say, well, it's not this and it's not that. So here's what Dogen says. Realization is not inborn. So Buddha nature, one could say, is inborn because it is the nature of all being. One is Buddha nature. This podium is Buddha nature. Your book is Buddha nature. Trees are Buddha nature. Anything you can call something is Buddha nature. And then there is things that you cannot say what they are. The ineffable things are also Buddha nature. So there's nothing outside the scope of what Buddha nature is, because it is all being. So in that sense, Buddha nature is inborn, right? But not inborn in the sense of just you. So, but realization, what is realization? So realization is this realization of Buddha nature, this enactment of Buddha nature, this embodiment of Buddha nature. Is that inborn? That's a question to ask yourself. Are we actually able to realize, bring forth, embody what is already there? Can we run away from it? Can we get rid of it? This thing? So Realization is not inborn, nor is it outside the self. So it's not separate from us. In Genjo Koan, I think it's at the end of the Genjo Koan, he says, you know, what is the nature of wind? And Master Bache says, you know, what, the student asks, well, why should we fan if there's already wind? And Master Bache says, well, you don't understand the nature of wind. You don't understand that you have to make an effort. You have to fan in order to make wind. And yet wind is already completely presencing itself. It's not something that's conjured out of nothing when you fan. So that's the first thing that Dogen says about what is it to say someone, some person, something, this person of great realization. Because that's the first question we should ask about this koan. We usually get to the end, right, and we say, oh, broken mirrors, right, can't be put back together again, and blossoms that fall off a tree can't be put back on. So that's where our mind goes. But maybe we should first ask the question. So Dogen's saying the first thing you should do is ask yourself, what does it say? What does it mean to say a realized person? And then he says, I like this one. Getting older does not mean you will meet realization out there somewhere. So in other words, hanging around, you don't run into realization. You think, oh, just the very nature of the fact that I'm kind of here and hanging around, it's just going to happen to me. Maybe it depends on where you're hanging around. Maybe if you're hanging around in a wholesome environment. There's another story that Dogen tells in the Zui Monkey, a book that he wrote in a series of stories about Dogen as a teacher. And Dogen tells a story about, not one of his students, but this is kind of a koan, in which the student's been working with the teacher the whole time, and he's been bringing him tea, and he's been taking care of him, and doing the things that students do for teachers, and this has been happening for a long time. And the student says, after a few years, the student says, well, why aren't you teaching me? Right? Because the student has a preconceived idea about what it means to be taught. Like the teacher is going to say, well, come over here, let me show you this book. Come over here and let me explain this koan to you. Come over here and let me do this thing. And that's teaching. But actually, in our tradition, teaching is doing these activities, this activity that we do together, this activity of the student-teacher relationship, this activity of coming to lectures and being with each other, this activity of finding out what it means to be an interconnected, communal, reciprocal relationship with each other. What does that mean? And part of what that means is we bump up against each other. So maybe in that way, if we hang around in that environment, something rubs off. But if we're just hanging around thinking that somehow we're going to run into the teaching, somehow it's just sort of going to be, enlightenment's going to be there for us. Well, Dogen's saying, oh, maybe not. Maybe it doesn't quite work that way. Then he says, realization does not come from brutalizing the self. By the way, I'm paraphrasing here. Realization does not come by brutalizing the self, yet we have to make effort. So I think as Americans, that's something we have problems with. And also we, just as human beings, we have problems with this because we make up a story in our mind about what realization is, or we make up a story about what practice is. So I've told this story before when I first went to Tassajara, to Sitangarya, which is 5 days of sitting. Essentially, it's how you enter into the monastery. You just go and you sit. So when I first heard about this, I thought, oh, I'm going to go and I'm going to sit all day and all night. I'm not going to go to bed. I'm just going to stay in the zendo. You know, I thought I was Bodhidharma. But why not? You read about Bodhidharma, he cut his eyelids off. Did you know that tea leaves are Bodhidharma's eyelids, and that's why you can stay awake? That's why it keeps you awake. So Bodhidharma is like 9 years of wall sitting. 9 years of sitting facing the wall. I don't think he went to the bathroom in 9 years. I don't think he ate anything in 9 years. I don't think he had a sip of water in 9 years. He must have been doing something, though, because Wakey cut off his arm in order to get Bodhidharma's attention. So Bodhidharma did dialogue with Wakey. So, but anyway, so I had these preconceived ideas about what it meant to sit Tathagata and be enlightened, and that was that I wouldn't get out of my seat. And I told this to Linda Ruth Kutz, who's one of the teachers at San Francisco Zen Center, and she said, well, why don't you just go and follow the schedule? A very profound statement, because that was very hard to do. But when I got there, after the first day, I knew there was not going to be any sitting in the middle of the night. I was so happy to go to bed that night. So happy to have breaks after the meals. So this realization does not come from brutalizing itself. It does include pushing us, right? And that's one of the edges that we have to find out about. That's one of the edges that we have to explore. What does it mean to push myself? What does it mean to be on that edge, right? And again, that's why we have teachers to dialogue with about this, to explore this, to understand what's too much and what's not enough. Because sometimes we are lazy, and sometimes we put our effort in exactly the wrong place, like we think we have to stay up all night. So there's this way in which it's not about brutalizing the self, yet we must make effort. So that it means we don't run into it just because we've been hanging around. The other thing that Dogen says about this is he says, realization is not defined in relationship to delusion. Now, that's a very interesting thing to say. Because we think that there's realization and there's delusion. We think to ourselves, realization is good, delusion is bad. So they become these diametrically opposed concepts. But Dogen's saying realization is not defined in relationship to delusion. Doesn't that kind of poke some holes in some ideas that we have about what we're up to? If in this koan, the question is, what happens when a person of great enlightenment still suffers from delusion? If where we go in that question is, there is the enlightened person and there is delusion, and there is this notion of suffering as bad, suffering as in a continuum towards delusion, not a continuum towards realization, then we've set up these two opposing camps of delusion and realization. So when we get to the second part of the story, we immediately think, oh, broken mirrors cannot reflect realization, and fallen blossoms cannot return to the tree, which we assume is realization. So, Dogen's saying, well, actually, realization cannot be defined in relationship to delusion, and delusion cannot be defined in relationship to realization. How does that work? So that's what this story is about, how that works, what that is. Then he says, I think this is a little harder. He says, we don't seek delusion, or the enlightened, realized person doesn't seek delusion in order to have the ground to plant the seed of realization. Not seeking, the person who is in realization does not seek out delusion in order to plant the seed of realization. I think for most of us, this is not a problem. This is like a really abstract thought. But I think that we do, sometimes, when we run into things that are unskillful, that are being perpetrated by someone in power, someone that we perceive as being realized in some particular venue, not necessarily spiritual, but in some way. Maybe we interpret that as a skillful means when it's not. Does that make sense to you? So we rationalize what is not skillful because we think that this person is planting the seed of realization through delusion. That's not necessary. That's not a necessary learning device. So, don't be fooled. Don't be fooled. Use your own discernment. A greatly enlightened person is further enlightened, and a greatly deluded person is still greatly enlightened as well. So this is a quote. A greatly enlightened person is further enlightened by delusion, and a greatly deluded person is still greatly enlightened as well. So this is an interesting quote here because it can be interpreted in two ways. If we interpret it from the position of the absolute, because greatly in this is the word Daigo, the name of the fascicle, great realization. So we say this greatly enlightened person is further enlightened. But we're talking about delusion, so they are further enlightened by delusion. And a greatly deluded person from the absolute, this greatly deluded person is also the person who is greatly enlightened. They are not two separate things or two separate states or two separate persons. This greatly deluded person, this great delusion is intimacy. Dogen's saying it is about intimacy with our life. It is about some real deep connection that we cannot get away from. This real deep intimacy and connection, which is our life itself, which is life itself, which is our relationship to all being, which is Buddha nature, which is delusion and realization not separate from each other. This delusion is also Buddha nature. Realization is Buddha nature. Do you think that delusion is outside the realm of Buddha nature? Is delusion somehow separate from? Is it something that we should get rid of? So he's saying, a greatly enlightened person is further enlightened, and a greatly deluded person is still greatly enlightened as well. So that's kind of mind-boggling. So that's to look at it from a non-dual point of view. If we look at it from a relative point of view, we could say that this greatly deluded person is still greatly enlightened, which is to say that in our delusion, we are not separate from our realization. When you do something, if we talk about delusion as being unskillful, we talk about it as an action, not a state of being, okay? Realization is not a state of being. Realization is an interconnected response to the totality of your experience. Dogen says, and he says, to carry, in Genjo Koan, to carry the self forward, in other words, to do something from a selfish point of view is delusion. To allow myriad things to come forward and meet you, which is everything, the totality of that situation comes forward. It's a reciprocal event. It is an active reciprocity. When your life is active reciprocity with the totality of what's happening in that moment, that is realization. So realization and delusion are not states. They're not static states of being. They are active, dynamic. They are not separate. So if, when you do something, let's say you've just done something really skillful. Everybody in this room has done something skillful at one time or another. And maybe often we do many skillful things. But we also do unskillful things. So when that person who did the skillful thing does something unskillful, what happens to the skillful person? Where does that skillful part of you go? Where did that skillful part of you come from? Where did the delusion unskillful person go? And where did the unskillful person come from? Because they're not separate. You're not separate. But not only that, we're not just talking about you internally as a human being, like there you have no relationship to the rest of the world. But there's also the rest of the world worlding the world. So what part of you that is unskillful that's also part of the myriad things coming forth, where did that person go? Where did that whole dynamic go? And where did it come from? And where did the skillful dynamic interaction with the totality of the whole universe and the world go, and where did it come from? It has no beginning and no end. So it means that Dogen's saying, when he says delusion and realization are not defined in relationship to each other, from a non-dual point of view, they are not separate, right? They don't go anywhere. They don't come from anywhere in that perspective. But from a relative point of view, there is unskillful behavior and there is skillful behavior. From the relative point of view, we act from the position of the realization of the totality of our Buddha nature. And from the deluded point of view, we don't respond from that place. We respond from a selfish place. This is really important because if we get too caught on the side of the absolute, we get confused. And we say, but what about ethics? What about morality? What about the precepts? What about the paramitas? But the ethics and the precepts and the paramitas all come from the side of the absolute. Because they are the enactment of the totality, the connectedness that we all have with each other. When we say, you know, don't kill, we're talking about don't steal. If we're talking about do not take what is not given. It's asking us to say, how can I be generous? It's asking us to be generous. That's the opposite of stealing, isn't it? Generosity. It's all asking us to not think of ourselves as just some kind of selfish, separate, unconnected human being. So that's where all these precepts and things come from. And when we're in a position where the precept do not kill, we couldn't live without killing. Everything we eat just about has been alive. It's not just whether or not you eat meat. If you're eating wheat, you're eating something that was once alive. Everything that sustains us that we eat has once been alive. So we have the precept, do not kill. We could not live without killing. That's true. And yet, how do we know what that means? If we take it from a literal point of view in which there is no wiggle room, how do we know what that means? We know what that means because we say, what is this in the totality of myriad things coming forth to meet my life? And when we start looking at the totality of the process of the lack of inherent existence of all being, we realize, actually everything is sustained by the birth and death of everything. So it is this total relationship, this process that we're part of, in which we receive our sustenance, in which we also give ourselves away to sustain others as well. So that's a way that we can talk about that and think about that. But when we kill because it's something that is convenient for us, when we kill because it's something that comes out of our selfishness, when we kill because it just is something that we would rather kill a fly in our house rather than open a window and let it fly out, then we can say, oh yeah, that's breaking a precept. Perhaps this is breaking a precept because I have this way to discern what it means to say, do not kill. I have this way of discerning that. To carry the self forward is an illusion, to allow myriad things to come forth and realize themselves with me, you know, together in this reciprocal relationship, is enlightenment. So we're not throwing morals and ethics or any of those things out the window when we talk about the absolute. So do not get caught in nihilism. Do not get caught in misunderstanding the nature of what this is about. Because it's not nothing. It's not nihilistic. It's totally something. Some many, many, many somethings all together. Singing. Right? Great giant chorus singing our world into existence. What's the relationship between realization and delusion? This is the next thing that Dogen talks about in this fascicle. So here's some of the things he says that you might be confused about. Whenever he says we might be confused about something, we should pay attention. Okay, here's a question. Is a person of great enlightenment who still suffers from delusion the same person, the same as a person who is not yet enlightened? So, if you are a person who has some states of realization, because remember, this is not, well, if we phrase this as a person of enlightenment, as if that's some kind of static state, as if that's like once enlightened, always enlightened, right? And that person still suffers from delusion. Oh, how could that be? Really? Isn't it disappointing to find out that the person of great realization also suffers from delusion? Like, what's all this work about? Right? What is all this practice about? If all this work we do to become realized means that we also get caught in delusion. What a bummer. You know? But isn't that what we find out the more we practice? We find out that it's not some kind of static state. So that's what he's pointing out, because that in our naivete, which is maybe a very good thing, that we come to practice with that mindset. Because practice is not easy. Because practice requires us to allow myriad things to come forth. It's so much easier when myriad things stay in their place. You know? Especially myriad people. Random branches falling out of trees. Okay, we can cope with that. But people are another matter altogether. So it's really difficult. He's asking us like to take on something. But also, on the other hand, it's really good news too, because it means that as deluded human beings, or as the Shin Buddhists like to say, as foolish human beings, we are not excluded from realized moments. We are not excluded from skillful action. That those things are not separate from each other. So, if a person of great enlightenment who still suffers from delusion, is that person the same person as one who is not yet enlightened? So that's kind of a dualistic idea. Although that's an interesting question. Is there a difference between having practiced, made this effort to live in communion with each other, made this effort to figure out what it means to be in these interconnected relationships, is that different or separate from the person who's not yet enlightened? Even though the person who's not yet enlightened is still completely intertwined and not separate from and completely is Buddha nature? And if you are that person who is not enlightened, if you are that person who feels themselves to be in a state of delusion, does that mean that you're completely precluded from the person you are when you are, have realization? Are you a completely different person from that person? Are you irredeemable? You know? I think you already know the answer to that question. And if you don't know the answer to that question, you should think about that deeply. Because if we say to ourselves, and it's interesting, we say, this is our child speaking, right? I am bad. I am good. We usually say, I am bad. We don't say, I did something that was unskillful. Isn't that much nicer? I did something that wasn't very helpful. That's so much nicer than I am bad. Like this indictment of the self. This is such a immature way for us to think. It's such a dramatic black and white way for us to think about ourselves. And yet we get caught in that. When we're feeling like, oh man, I can never dig myself out of this hole. But we really, that really cannot, again, I am bad is the same as saying I am enlightened. I am bad is to say I am in a state of badness which will have no beginning and end. It will go on endlessly. To say I am enlightened is to say that I am this state of enlightenment that it will go on endlessly. But even that person that we acknowledge as we think as being this state of endless enlightenment is also delusion, caught in delusion and suffering. And sometimes, perhaps more often, skillful than not, but inevitably at some point unskillful. Perhaps we are caught in a position where we feel like we are more unskillful than not, but inevitably skillful. Does a person's delusion come from their realization? Are they making delusion to express realization? Does a person's delusion come from their realization? Well, we would probably say no. But that's an interesting thing to think about because it's completely opposed to how we normally think about this. So Dogen's saying, have you thought about this? Have you tried flipping the coin? Have you tried shifting this sentence around and asking yourself exactly how this works? Does the realized person who returns to delusion bring delusion from a distant place which then covers their great, great realization? Okay, so does the realized person who finds themselves engaged in delusional thinking or a delusional situation, I suppose, bring delusion from some distant place? In other words, this delusion has nothing to do with them and they had to go out and find it. This realized person had to go out and look for delusion. I'm the marketplace of delusion. I am now going to go to the distant town of Yaoling, because this is in China, right? They're going to go to that distant town and they're going to find delusion and they're going to bring it back. And then it's going to cover their realization. So it's an absurd thought. Where is this distant place? Is delusion so divorced from realization that it must be conjured up as some place far away from us? Or we would say, well, no, actually, I don't have to conjure up delusion. It finds me. I don't have to go to a distant place to find delusion. But if we're talking about this hypothetical realized person, well, surely they must have to go somewhere else to find delusion. Surely they must have to go to some distant place to become deluded. I mean, surely not them, this exalted person. And, you know, this sounds kind of silly in a way, but think about somebody who you don't know, who you've decided is an enlightened human being. I think the Dalai Lama is a good, excuse me, Tenzin Gyatso, but the Dalai Lama is a great example because most of us don't know him. Most of us don't hang out with him. Most of us don't know whether he likes cocoa over coffee. Most of us don't know what he does when he gets frustrated. Most of us don't know what kind of shoes he likes. So we have this notion about the Dalai Lama, right? He's like a perfect human being. He always is like, he's in that show and he sees you and he laughs and you just know, you know, like you're the best person. You're as good as sliced bread. I mean, you're the best. When you are around the Dalai Lama, you just know, you know, that this is like, and we all say, oh, I would so like to be like that. Wouldn't you like to be like that? As soon as you arrive somewhere, you're smiling and gosh-showing, and everybody's gosh-showing back, and they're smiling to you, and they're like, what can I get you? Oh, let me knock myself out to be around you. You are so perfect and wonderful. You are the Dalai Lama, right? You say, Buddhism is not my religion. My religion is compassion. I mean, it's stunning, isn't it? Is that what we think enlightenment is? Because I could almost guarantee you that if we probably spent a lot of time with the Dalai Lama, we would think he was a great guy, but we would also know the things that bugged him, right? We would find out that actually he likes one kind of drink over another. He likes one kind of shoes over another. He probably gets annoyed at things. We would find out about the times when we started to understand subtly his body language. We would get it, that he was not happy. But because we are not in his presence like that, we aren't intimate with him, we don't see that. We only see our own projections on him of who he is as a person. And those projections become our projections about what realization is. They become our projections about what it means to be enlightened. The other thing about him is he is a specific person. So your skillful enlightenment is going to appear to be a different thing than the Dalai Lama's skillful enlightenment, because you're not Tibetan. You weren't brought up in his environment. You don't have the same genetic makeup that he does. You know, it's like you're just a different person. You live a different life. So you're going to be responding in different ways. Because enlightenment, again, is about reciprocity. It's about the totality of your total experience. It's about interacting. It's an interactive event throughout time and space. So what your enlightened response is going to be different and look different in all likelihood than Tenzin Gyatso's enlightened response. It's interesting, you know, we call him by his title. The Dalai Lama is a title. The Dalai Lama, I believe his name is Tenzin Gyatso, right? So we don't call him Tenzin Gyatso, we call him the Dalai Lama. That also adds a certain layer to this that affects the way we think about things. Anyway, something to think about. So this is what Dogen's talking. He's saying, think about these things. Don't just take all this at face value. Question this. And when you look at these questions, question in a relationship to your own ideas about yourself, your own ideas about who you are, your own ideas about your practice. Because how you project onto another person, how you project onto someone that you consider to be enlightened, is saying something to you about who you are and your ideas about what practice is. Our practice has to be who we are. Our practice is individual to us. Our practice is also bigger than we are. Our practice, because we're practicing a particular school of Buddhism, or because we're practicing Buddhism, because we're in a certain place and time, we're going to be doing certain practices. But it's also about the particularity of who you are as a person. All right, so here's what some of the things that Dogen says about this. He says, in any event, you should know that to understand a greatly enlightened person is, in any event, you should know that when you understand a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded, this is the intrinsic and central constituent of practice. All right? In any event, you should know that when you understand, or you should know that to understand, a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded. So when you understand this relationship, when you understand what this is about, then you understand the intrinsic and central aspect of practice. If we don't understand the relationship for ourselves about our delusion and our realization and what those are, when we don't understand what this idea of realization, if you will, the goal of our practice is, if we don't know what the Bodhisattva path is in relationship to this issue of realization and delusion, then we can't practice, right? If we have this fixed notion about them being two diametrically opposed states of mind, that's a problem. That's a problem. So that is an essential question here. Dogen's saying this is an essential question about your practice. What is the relationship? First of all, what is realization? What is delusion? What is it in space and time? What is it defined as notions and preconceived ideas? So that's one thing. So, and then the next thing is, how is it? How is it? How is this? How? What is this relationship that we have personally with these words and concepts, and also with these words and concepts as the totality and the reciprocity of the totality of our lives, the totality of the whole world manifesting itself? So this is big, big question. But we can only answer the question here. We can only answer the question through our own vow and our own practice. So Heejin Kim, who's a scholar, wrote this. He said, delusion and enlightenment are not strange bedfellows. On the contrary, they are working companions. They are working companions that need each other, that need one another, with a shared purpose of actualizing sulfurific liberation. We need them with the shared purpose of actualizing sulfurific. Sulfurific refers to saving. So the way I understand this, this is the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. Impossible. And yet, they are koans, this koan. Delusions are endless, I vow to end them. This is that very black and white version. But we know that if they're endless, they cannot be ended. So what does that mean? And that's that question about practice we're being asked in this case. What is realization? What is delusion? What is ending? What is entering? What is something without beginning and without end? This question about practice. What does it mean to save all beings? Save is a tough word for us because it has so many Christian connotations to it. So what does it mean to say we benefit all beings? What does that mean? So that's what Dogen's saying here. He's saying this, please let me end this with this fact that this question is central to our practice. And next week, I will talk about the second part. Thank you very much.